Saturday afternoon around 12:30, we're at the Los Angeles Memorial Coliseum, and there are a number of armored personnel carriers and jeeps located outside the Coliseum. A number of armored personnel are walking. Armed personnel are walking around with machine guns at the ready, and they're all in riot clothing. They look like they're all lined up, like they're ready to be in some sort of a convoy of some sort.
How would you describe your community today?
Angry, highly upset.
I don't like the one bit of it. It seems like I want to do something about it, but I just can't.
On April 29th, 1992, a California jury acquitted four Los Angeles police officers in the beating of Rodney King. The beating had been caught on camera and was viewed by millions across the country. Many reacted with anger and disbelief, and protests were held in many cities. In the tension-filled neighborhoods of South Central Los Angeles and neighboring Compton, police efforts to suppress the protests backfired, and for 3 days the area was immersed in a wave of destruction, in which businesses were burned, people were injured, and hundreds of arrests were made. The aftermath of the King verdict, alternately referred to either as the L.A. riots or the L.A. uprising, eclipsed a less publicized event earlier that month, when representatives from two of L.A.'s largest gangs, the Crips and the Bloods, held a national press conference to declare a truce. For the next hour, we'll hear the story of that truce and some of the history of the gangs in L.A. as told by past and present gang members, gang specialists, journalists, and youth counselors in their own voices, and we'll hear about some of the grassroots programs initiated to help urban youth steer clear of drugs and violence and to become productive leaders in their communities.
They could solve this without violence.
You think they can?
I think so, they could.
I wanted to stop.
Yeah, and what did that make you feel like when you heard the verdict? How did you feel inside?
I feel like, yeah, I was him. Like he was real close to me.
Even though you don't know him?
Yep.
If you all could do something because of the verdict, what would you want to do right now? Who would you want to talk to? What would you want to change?
The system.
Everybody watches as across our nation every day, our inner cities continue to fall deeper and deeper into decay. Day by day. As truth and justice is washed away. Away. And a chosen few, well, they're forced to pay. As screaming sirens rushes to drive-by violence, leaving loved ones grieving and homeboys vowing to get eaten. Everybody watches, but the eyes just...
Everyone knows me as Twilight Bay. I grew up in Watts. I'm 32 years of age. And for 10 years of my life, I was involved in gang activity. That was the lifestyle that I was involved in. I was 14 years old and stood next to my friend who was shot in the face, and his blood was all over my face, you know, and watched him murdered in the street. You know, I've seen more and more of my friends die like that. And by the time I was 18, certain things had happened in my life. Passing of my grandmother, the news of the fact that I was about to be a father. Reading the autobiography of Malcolm X just opened up a whole aspect of who I was and the legacy of my people that I was totally oblivious to. And when they asked me, would I be interested in sitting at the table with my so-called rivals, I said, yeah, I could do that. One of the things that I think a lot of people get away from when they talk about, or don't really get into when they talk about Bloods, Crips, gang members, how did they come about? What is their purpose? Why are they going towards peace? You know, basically I say to them, look at who we are. We are the orphans of the civil rights movement, left with no leadership, no guidance. We had to resurrect ourselves. And in resurrecting ourselves, we had to self-educate. We had to relearn all of our history. We had to relearn all of the trials and tribulations, not only our trials and tribulations, but the trials and tribulations of all those who have come to this country seeking a better opportunity, you know, and understanding the plight of all of the people who are here, you know, and analyzing this situation properly. And we've come to the conclusion that, you know, America, the concept, has yet to be what it was meant to be.
My name is Alejandro Alonso, and I'm a graduate student working on my PhD at the University of Southern California. Well, I was doing some research on sort of the growth and development and proliferation of gangs in LA County. So I was able to, with acquiring some data from the past, determine how many gangs existed in the early 70s how that developed in, throughout the 80s, and then with some field work that I did in the 1990s, really look at how gangs and gang territories have expanded. And for example, one of the things I found was that in 1972, there were about 18 black gangs in LA County, and by 96, when I went out in the field, there was 274 black gangs. One of the things that I found that a lot of the sociologists and other gang researchers don't talk about is, how does a gang form? A lot of the research discusses, you know, why gangs exist, or how come gangs are growing, or how come they proliferate, but they never get at the core of the question of how did this gang form in a place that didn't exist before. And one of the things I found is that with black gangs and the Latino gangs in Los Angeles in the 1940s, they primarily developed not as gangs, but they formed as social groups, and they were considered sort of community protectors against different social ills that were taking place. And what happened over time is that these groups eventually developed different types of philosophies and agendas and became criminal over time. But the initial groups formed because of, one, police brutality that was taking place in Los Angeles in the 40s and 50s, and two, a lot of racial conflict coming from primarily Anglo communities who were uncomfortable with the migrations of blacks into LA County in the South and Hispanics that were coming from Mexico during the 40s and 50s as well. So I think at the root of gang formation is racial conflict and police brutality is what actually formed the gangs. And then when you talk about how come they've spread, how come they've developed, how come they've proliferated, then you're really addressing a completely different set of questions that are discussing deindustrialization, unemployment, poverty, and a different set of social problems. So there's two things going on. One is why gangs formed, which is, according to my thesis, have a lot to do with racial conflict, and how come gangs have proliferated and spread and have sustained, and it has to do a lot about the economics and the poverty in the region.
So a lot of these urban centers all over the country where African-American and other people who were looking for opportunity had migrated to from the South found themselves with absolutely nowhere to work.
Twilight Bay.
You know, no way of sustaining themselves, and with the cost of living so high, you know, not being able to really save any money to go back to where they came from, even if there was anything to go back to, you know. So basically you had a community that was suffering under a politically motivated economic embargo. You know, because at the same time that all of these things were taking place, and the Panthers, the US organization, you had the Watts riots of 65, you had the assassination of Dr. King and Malcolm X, you had all of the riots that took place around those times. And far as I'm concerned, in my opinion, to me, for the government to do the things that they did, that that pretty much gave way to a lot of these corporations abandoning the urban cities. It would, to me, it most definitely looked as if it was a politically motivated embargo against the inner cities. And that gave way to economic deprivation, disenfranchisement, the destabilization of the community, the fragmentation of the family. Welfare became a bigger thing. More and more people were getting welfare. And as a result of that, a lot of women had to, in many ways, separate from their husbands or their children's fathers in order to get the welfare. The man couldn't be in the home. So you have a situation where you're fragmenting families and creating dysfunctional families. And as a result of that, here it is, these kids with no father in the home, father with no way of getting a job for himself, and living in a society that says the man is supposed to provide for the woman, not being able to do that, and how that may affect the man's self-esteem. You know, give way to self-medicating, alcoholism, drug abuse. Then you got the drug. Then you got the vets coming home with drug problems, and also being hated by the people in the very country that they felt that they were fighting to protect. You know, so a lot of them had chemical dependency problems, and then you had a whole generation of kids with no guidance, no one to instruct them, teach them, show them the way. Being exposed to these black exploitation films, no wonder we had this whole culture of self-destruction evolve out of these communities where people had just been focused on self-determination, economic justice, political justice, social justice, and trying to really bring about some change. And in my opinion, really make the philosophy of America manifest itself for them. And the reality of the situation is that, as far as I'm concerned, they're very clever social engineers in this country. They know exactly what to do. They know exactly how to play it out. And the history of these neighborhoods go right back into the civil rights and liberation movement of the 60s and the 70s. And a lot of what went on with the FBI's COINTELPRO and how they manipulated the Black Panther Party and the US organization and the things that happened around those issues also affected and helped to give way to what eventually became the Crips and the Bloods. You know, because during the Vietnam War, a lot of the older gangs, guys from the gangs that predated the Bloods and Crips, were drafted into the war and sent overseas into the war. And so you had a whole culture of gangs where they were basically social clubs, really, of individuals who grouped together for the purposes of protecting their communities against racial attacks. You know, and when these guys were absorbed into the war, that gave way to a new generation of youngsters in the neighborhood who usually would hang out at the local team post. After the team posts were closed, they had nowhere to hang out, but they all were still friends and they hung together. And from that, you had young people who were being influenced by either the US organization or the Black Panther Party. And you had these new gangs, the Brims, Pyrus, the Crips, and there was a faction of Crips before they were gang members who were known as the Baby Panthers, and they were a part of the whole political scene. And as time went on and the assaults took place, as far as the FBI going after the Panther Party quite aggressively, these young people who were looking to the Panthers and the US organization for leadership found themselves with no one to continue to guide them. A lot of Panthers were forced into exile, a lot were in prison, and others just went underground and never resurfaced. And here it is, right around the time that took place, you had the black exploitation films, and these young people whose minds have been being exposed to political thoughts and dealing with social justice and dealing with rights for the disenfranchised and the disregarded in this country, left with no leadership, no guidance, and impressionable minds, and basically exposed to images of dope dealers, pimps, prostitutes, and them being able to live this glamorous lifestyle, you know, in which Hollywood is quite clever at giving these illusions to people. And you had a lot of young people get involved in that thought process. And just as that happened, you had a lot of vets returning from the war who had major chemical dependency, drug dependency problems. And basically, it was like the youth had been transformed overnight.
Warriors, come forth and lead our people to freedom, like that tournament to do.
The early gang leaders, many of them was off track, but many of them had a sense of consciousness because they had grew out of the void that the Black Panthers and the other organizations that were around had left.
Umday, founder of the Watts Prophets.
Mm-hmm. This is a letter written in April 7th, 1974 from Raymond Washington. Raymond Washington is the founder, bar none, of the Crips and the Bloods. He was killed a few years ago. But I suppose in listening to and looking at this letter this morning, I guess what you're saying and what the youngsters are saying today is the same problem that they had in 1974 they have today, and they're still trying to solve it. Raymond sent us this in 1974, and it was the direction that they wanted the Crips to go in and the gangs. And I just want to read it. It was called The Crips Charter Request. Initially, our organization, the Crips, was a gang of young black men who were seeking identity, purpose, and relevance in this society. A society which sought to deprive us of our identity and demean our purpose and relevance in this society. Many times our endeavors to find this identity, purpose, and relevance resulted in acts which were destructive to ourselves, our community, and our people. To those residents of the black community of Southern California, and especially of Los Angeles, Compton, and Watts area, the word Crips connotes trouble. This is due to fact that since our inception, about 3 years ago, up until recently, we committed many blind acts of violence and aggressions upon the person and property of the residents of these black communities. Many of us have been arrested and imprisoned for committing crimes against our communities. And while incarcerated, many of us have utilized the time wisely and in a most beneficial manner by examining and evaluating the adverse relationship that existed between us and our communities, our people. Thus, we have come to acknowledge our faults. And from these acknowledgments, we have decided to pursue a course which we trust will lead to the eradication of the conditions which gave birth to the negative forces that we once were. This was from Raymond Washington, the founder, original founder, and this was the guy who founded the Crips. What happened to that direction? A thing called crack cocaine sort of changed that direction. And it has raised the level of violence, the level of cruelty, and it has sort of changed the direction of what these young people originally kind of seeing the end of the tunnel, seeing another way to do things. They were growing, they were getting older, but as the drugs came in, more guns came in, the violence level raised, etc. I just wanted to say that, and this is a beautiful letter from Raymond.
Well, I think when crack came in the early 80s, that was a major change of the gang landscape.
Alejandro Alonso.
Because they were, especially with the black gangs, they were able to control the crack markets on the street level and create a major profit with those monies, and in turn able to buy more weapons for the protection of their turf. And some have argued that one of the reasons why the homicides started to escalate throughout the 80s was because of the crack trade. But today's gang climate, although still involved with narcotics, still involved with the peddling of different types of drugs, it doesn't seem to be like a major issue that it once was in the 80s. You don't hear a lot about this drug warfare, although the drugs are still there. Hispanic gangs control the methamphetamine. There's a big distribution network of ecstasy. And marijuana, especially certain high qualities of marijuana, are on the rise and are plentiful in Los Angeles compared to 10, 15 years ago. But it doesn't seem to translate into the crime that it did in the 80s, so it doesn't come up as a major issue. Well, I'm sure if you talk to police officers, it's always going to be a major issue. But in terms of comparing today to the 80s, it doesn't have that same impact.
I looked at the moon, so full and so bright.
So bright.
And then at my fireplace, with its flickering light.
Flickering light.
And soon realized why this evil, racist world will never be right.
Never be right.
And then I threw another log on the fire.
Let it burn.
Inside my four walls. Well, see, I feel like a king.
Royalty. King.
But outside my door, it don't mean a damn thing.
A damn thing.
Still, I pay all my dues, yet I have only a partial membership in world happenings.
Happenings.
And my blood.
My blood.
My blood. My precious blood. Well, it flows freely in all foreign and domestic wars.
World War II.
So
Korea,
I threw another log
Vietnam.
On a fire.
Let it burn.
Why do you insist on keeping us caged?
Why?
You know all that does is intensify racism, hate, and rage.
And rage.
The word now is no justice, no peace. And three strikes, you're out.
You're out.
So I threw another log on the fire.
Let it burn.
Putting us in a cage was a mistake.
Was a mistake.
All that did was intensify racism and hate. Now shackled to our cages, you expect us to wait.
And wait.
And while you fool around in a shuttle.
And wait.
And then police the world, stealing their gold.
And wait.
While we get less and less and less
and less and less.
The Rodney King trial has become a kind of international test of the meaning of African-American citizenship in this society. It's not merely a question of justice. It's a question of what 450 years of struggle has been all of us.
author and historian Mike Davis.
So it's forced the struggle for just elementary democratic rights to take a different form, and sometimes an insurrectionary form. And this was certainly the case in Los Angeles, and it's certainly true of all the actions around the country, from Las Vegas to Toronto, from Berkeley to Atlanta, that acted in coordination, in sympathy, or solidarity with events in Los Angeles. Because it becomes obvious that the struggle for that minimum democratic rights of citizenship has to flow back in the streets. The institutions have failed us, and the whole world's been reading that meaning. Of course, on the streets of South Central LA, people's motivations might be determined a little differently. If you talked to a lot of youth who are out in the streets, they would keep telling you things like Rodney King's Only the Trigger. We have so many grievances. We have so many dead homeboys. We've seen so many people of color murdered in the city. And this forces you to confront Los Angeles's quite extraordinary history, which is for no less than 50 years and probably longer, the African-American community and its allies in Los Angeles have been struggling to establish a single precedent of justice in regard to police treatment of blacks. As we all know, there's not been a year that there hasn't been a new martyr in Los Angeles. There hasn't been an African-American who's been brutalized, usually killed by the police or sheriffs. Never once, not on any single occasion, has justice been meted out to African-Americans. The police have won without exception every single case. And it's the weight of that history, where there's not even a symbolic victory, where there's been, you know, no safety valve, that exploded. It's also been the fact of this extraordinary so-called war on gangs and drugs conducted by the LAPD, which has succeeded in criminalizing youth of color in the city without exception. And of course, this has been a repression, a campaign that's been widely tolerated by liberals in this city. I mean, it strikes me that one of the things that we have to discuss frankly and openly is why, when Operation Hammer began and the civil liberties of black youth in the city were reduced to less than zero, most of the civil liberties establishment in the city chose not to focus on it. But there's a recession on it. The real savage edge of that impact is cut basically through the communities of new immigrants in Los Angeles, where unemployment rates have tripled, and where there is largely no social safety net to absorb any of the impact of the recession. People are in free fall. I mean, their lives are literally falling apart as they lose those minimum wage jobs. And you see the symptoms of it almost everywhere. Before Christmas, 20,000 largely Latino women and their children waiting all night for turkeys and blankets. Why? A single story in the LA Times about welfare rolls tripling. The appearance of new colonies of the homeless, but no longer just of single men, but of whole families. Latino homeless on the top of Crown Hill, in the bed of the LA River. Everywhere around us, a recession turned into a depression and destroying the hopes of particularly the latest levels of immigrants. So, I mean, the volcano that erupted in looting all across the city was based on, you know, despair, and it was based on need, and it was based on a largely unperceived, unreported, unacted upon social emergency in Los Angeles. What kind of overall political conclusion do we draw? First of all, this riot has been a miracle. It has at least temporarily ended a gang warfare in South Central LA, which, as you know, is taking hundreds and hundreds of lives every year. But it has produced a miracle, you know, amongst the gang youth who played a large role in this. And of course, 1965 did too. I have a picture hanging in my wall, which I'm quite haunted by, which shows an overturned police car and then a group of black youth, some of them giving the old Watts gang sign, some of them getting the Slauson sign. 65 produced 5 years of gang peace in South Central LA. It also produced the Black Panther Party in Los Angeles, which is one of the things the LAPD is obviously most worried about right now. That seems to be happening. People who have largely been written off as the hardcore criminal class in the city showed themselves capable of not only being the architects of peace, you know, a peace that no one expected was possible, but architects now of the whole political program. And it's now become obvious that the idea that a whole generation of youth in the inner city, which the rest of the society has thrown on the scrap heap and basically condemned to a form of social cultural death, refused to accept this, have probably long understood the real nihilistic consequences of gang warfare, but have never had an opportunity, a set of conditions that made it possible for you lay down your arms, I'll lay down my arms. That's now happened in the city. And I think progressive people in the city must find this an enormous cause for hope. But it's a situation that's highly unstable. Unstable because this whole process is under vicious and almost daily attack by the police. Gang meetings in the projects for the purposes of peace have been raided by the police. The police are doing everything they can to incite it. It's terribly important that we pull, you know, the police off the gangs, you know, to do everything we can to support this gang peace, and that there's somebody in the city on some political level who actually has the guts and political courage to listen to what the gangs have to say, because they have a lot of ideas. They have a lot of ideas about how to bring peace to the city, how to reconstruct the city. They also, in my mind, are probably the only really social democratic political constituency in the city. So the gang truce that come about, and the possibility of gang youth becoming a political constituency in the city, is something that progressives have to applaud and have to support.
My name is Dida Kamati, a.k.a. Kenneth Carr. I'm a member of the All African People's Revolutionary Party. I live in Los Angeles in the jungle. First of all, I worked with three major gang truces, starting back in 1986-87 in Venice, and then in Long Beach and in L.A. And for us, the only solution to gang violence is revolution and is restructuring gangs from being gangsters or lumping proletariat, pimping off of the realities of the African working class, the middle class, through exploitation of drugs, violence, and so forth and so on, and become revolutionaries. And this, we may be able to roll it back through two things. One is exposing the role of the CIA and bringing in cocaine, crack, into our community, which becomes the gasoline, the fuel, to raise the level of social organization into gangster criminal behavior activity over this thirst for profits and turf controlling, selling, and smoking, all this kind of madness. And the other, of course, is through the gang truce phenomenon that basically struggle with young folks to understand why the Ku Klux Klan may give them awards for having killed more Africans than the Ku Klux Klan ever did in the whole reign of terror in existence, you know? So by raising that consciousness, we firmly believe that we need to educate our young people who the true enemy is. The true enemy is not a fellow brother, Latino brother, who we've been in struggle with since the days that the Seminoles and Mexico went to war at the Battle of Alamo to not let Texas become a slave state in solidarity with African slaves living in Texas. The true war is against the ruling class that has, brings in these drugs, that mandates massive unemployment to reduce the militancy of trade union movements and to maximize our desire for violence, so we're quick to go and attack Afghanistanis. And we look around, I never saw an Afghanistani in the jungle where I live or in South Central in my life. I've never seen one here. They're not my enemy. But I've seen a whole lot of racist police. I've seen a whole lot of images that are worse than weapons because the psychological subliminal impact, it's hard to determine. You shoot me, I can feel the wound. The psychological images of the mannequin leitmotif and the constant negation of that which is black and their glorification subliminally and sublimely in terms of form, shape, image, and direction is a very powerful psychological tool to keep the oppressed oppressed. When young people commit acts of violence, it has a therapeutic effect. If it's against the enemy, if it's against each other, it promotes intense tribal warfare like the Hutus and the Tutsis in Rwanda and Burundi. I mean, for us, the most scientific way out is to leave antisocial youth organizations that promote antisocial behavior against other youth, and not just youth, young men and adults, because it's all related, and for them to join progressive, if not revolutionary, organizations, like the All African People's Revolutionary Party, like the Black Liberation Army, like the Republic of New Africa, like the Nation of Islam, like La Raza Unida, like Four Directions, like the International Indian Treaty Council. The list goes on. Bayan for the Filipino community, KDP for the Korean gang members, and so forth. That's the only solution, because you directly address the major contradiction, which is capitalism. Now, I'm not dissing, and I know Nani and a lot of these cats, Daoud, Twilight, I know all these cats, Jim Brown, for years, and we've worked together. In fact, they've given us awards for the work we've done in terms of gang truces, and bringing unity. But they're progressive, and they're dealing with the immediate needs of gang members, food, clothing, shelter, jobs, references, assistance in legal defense, probation, parole, recommendations for employment when you get out, all these kind of things, And that work will continue to go on, because mamas and the children and the papas going to see that level of work is being done. Where we're falling far short, though, is looking to permanent long-term solutions. I think that most of the cats who run these programs are progressive, but you got to realize most of the cats themselves are ex-gang members. And one of the biggest crises facing gang members or anybody coming out of penitentiary is how do you make a legal income? And of course, the fact that because of mass movements, we stopped the flow of cocaine into South Los Angeles, so that economic opportunity is gone. So that's gone now. As I mentioned before, the next epidemic is heroin. And the whole role of the United States in the Far East, it's not just about oil, though I think clearly that's the major phenomenon, but it's also about drugs and heroin. And the Taliban, as you well know, banned opium production. There's not even a central government in Afghanistan today. According to the New York Times, the flow of heroin has radically increased. The epidemic that hit the Bay Area, hit D.C., and it's spreading. The quality and quantity is pure. It's smokable. And, you know, we live in a culture where putting a needle in your arm is kind of taboo. But we smoke anything. We've been socialized that way through the cigarette industry and you know, Normal, some other groups out here, which I support. But anyway, so our next concern, and for all those in the listening audience, you need to put together watchdog committees, research, scholars, within the churches, within community-based organizations, a major offense against the United States' upcoming heroin epidemic or explosion. We can look at Gary Webb's Dark Alliance, Mike Ruber's tapes, so much Maxine Waters' statements in Congress. There's so much documentation of the role of the CIA and government agencies in pushing drugs, not only for social engineering purpose to depopulate Africans out of South Central, because these are critical transportation corridors for that mass movement of finished products from Asia, but also to decentralize our population through these small towns throughout Riverside and San Bernardino, like Fontana and Moreno Valley and Rialto, I mean, all over, where we're decentralized, living in suburban communities where your nearest neighbor is like a half acre away, and we cease being a political threat. Because remember, Los Angeles has had two major rebellions that actually have sparked rebellions throughout the world. So L.A. impacts the world, whether it's through the Black Liberation Movement or Kwanzaa, that whole cultural nationalism phenomena, or the Black Panther Party, kind of Oakland, L.A. phenomena. L.A. and Africans in L.A. are role models for third world youth. I mean, guerrillas and Angola were naming themselves Tupac, you know, fighting UNITA and Jonas Savimbi, who, by the way, just got defeated. So L.A. is a critical center, and we know for a fact that there's an exorbitant number of intelligence strategies and agents and programs that are applied to all sectors of Los Angeles to make sure L.A. stays under the popular media, the popular psychological image of their portrayal of us worldwide. And the conscious sector of youth in our community, the revolutionary youth, and the ones tied to spoken word, and to the hip-hop, and the b-boy, and the breaking, and the, you know, and the graffiti, and the ones working with the Black student unions, and the ones working with African think tanks, and the ones that got study circles all over the community, and the ones that go to the junior colleges and come back and turn the homies on to political education, and the ones that go to prison, and in prison, people like Geronimo Pratt, and Matulu Shakur, and Odinga, and Rochelle McGee, have their brothers reading the autobiography of Malcolm X, reading African history, and come back transformed if they don't join the Moorish Nation in prison, or don't join the Black Liberation Army in prison, or don't join prison in different positive formations in the prison. You never hear about that. You know, so that's how we look at it. You know, and that's the revolutionary progressive side of the coin. And I'm not player hating the Foundation brothers and sisters, and especially those that are at least trying within those conservative rubrics to introduce traditional cultures, spiritual cultures, like Nani's doing with the Aztec and indigenous culture, and other groups are doing, you know. We want more of that to occur, because you cannot transform these youth without understanding their culture, their history, and the class contradictions you face under capitalism.
About the money, and it ain't about the fame. I'm straight out the projects, and I still remain the same. Every time I leave the stage, I got the same brown face. And when I grip the mic, a ceremony takes place. The future is tomorrow, the past was yesterday, but our souls are in the present, and still I see no change. Borders all across the seven continents, like slaves in chains, it makes my soul sick. Booyah! And if you don't know, check it out, y'all. We came the flow, so keep booyah! And if you don't know, check it out, y'all.
My name's Hector Marroquin. I'm with No Guns. That stands for Networks Organizing for Gang Unity and Neighborhood Safety. We're a nonprofit organization that started back in 94. And we're committed to stopping the violence on the streets and trying to change lives. We are ex-gang members who have went through the transition in our lives. And what I mean is that we went from negative to positive. During the course of our program, we've been helping youth at risk make the same transition. We've taken maybe about 200 kids to the city hall. I mean, gang members from all rival gangs to the city hall for one common goal, to ask for jobs. And the reason for jobs is because everybody knows if they look at you bald-headed, baggy pants, they ain't gonna wanna give you a job. They never wanna give these youth the chance to find out who they are or what they're about. So bottom line, that's what we do. We're giving them the chance that they're not giving out on the streets. We try to get them employment, job referrals. We give them papers to help them out in court, you know, to help them better themselves. We've gotten certain kids back into school. We've gotten some into college. We've gotten some that never had a diploma from high school, their GEDs, and got them jobs. And basically, that's what we're here for, you know, to try to better the community, you know, and try to change one life at a time. We got a transportation business that keeps us stable. So what we do is we transport kids that go to after-school programs that are trying to change. I mean, because a lot of the kids we deal with are probation kids, kids that have been through problems. So what we're doing is we're taking these kids to the after-school programs, and a lot of times when they're late, they run late. So when they get out of these programs, by the time they go home, you know, rather than walking through South Central late at night, we transport them from the school to their homes, door to door. And that's how basically we're funded. We do got contracts with the city doing gang intervention, which we go out on the streets and we intervene on a lot of high-risk problems out there in the community. And we deal with the gang members on a daily basis. We talk to them. We help with the graffiti removal. A lot of times, if you got a neighborhood doing certain graffiti in certain areas, we'll go to that gang and we'll have talks with them to whoever's calling shots in the neighborhood. And we'll go back and, hey, you know, talk to them, reason with them. You know, we ain't going to beg them. We ain't trying to pressure them, but we'll give them one reason to try to help us, to better that community. And the one reason is a job opportunity. Jobs save lives, bottom line. And, you know, a lot of the guys we work with, you know, they've been through it. Hardcore, that don't want to be hardcore no more. All they want to be there is for their families, you know, for their children, for their mothers, their fathers. They want to better themselves. They want a good paying job. So rather than we kind of negotiate with them, we'll go out there, you know, you guys work, you know, keep the community going smooth here. We'll go out there and look for resources for your neighborhood, for you guys, because a lot of the people point their gang members. Those are terrorists. But nobody seems to realize that those are your kids. Those are my kids. They're our neighbors' kids. And all those kids that are out there doing negative are just being pushed away. Nobody's actually paying attention or giving them the time of day. So because they're not getting the time of day, they're all grouping together and struggling to make money. Drugs, robberies, you know, any other way they can, extortion, prostituting, you know, they got to do what they got to do. But if you go to them and give them positive ways, give them the day of time, you know, give them that chance that nobody wants to give them. Believe me, that guy you think that will be the most negative will be the best person there to protect you. Rather than you always fearing him and thinking he's going to rob you, he'll be the one there to defend you, keep you from getting robbed.
My name is George Chavalos Tejeda. I'm also from the No Guns Organization. Myself, one of the number of things that we got going with the people on the streets, which is the gang members, that we can relate. We can relate with them, you know, because we come from the same background, you know. We come from the same yard. Like, you know, most of us, that's the way we express ourselves, because some of us come from jail, some of us come from the streets, because some of us, we didn't have a father and a mother at the house, or just been up there doing negative. So, me, myself, what I had done, I used my past as an example to send a message to the kids so I can become better in my life and become successful and be able to reach my goals and teach them what drugs can do to them, what gangbanging can do to them, and all the things that I went through in life myself, because it was an experience that I went through that I can use now and that I've been using, showing these kids to don't get involved with, because I believe that also even my kids is everybody's future. something I don't used to know. But something I learned also, when you're around negative, you're going to stay negative. You be around positive people, you stay positive. And that's one thing no guns has shown me, because those are the ones that opened the doors to me to become successful in life and become a responsible father also, and responsible myself, and learn how to love myself and care about myself before I do it for someone else. And it's a lot of people that don't give, no, like he said, it, gay members a chance in this world to find themselves, see what they're all about. Because me, myself, I don't used to know nothing about myself but negative. Everything was negative because that was the kind of people I was around. But I came right here with Hector Marroquin for No Guns, and he did open the doors to me. And it wasn't easy. It was a step that I took in life that I had to go back to school to become successful, to be able to reach my goal, you know, work and just be able to do for other people. It was just not just come and work. It was just to go back to school first before I get where I'm at right now. And it's a good feeling. And if it was more people like Hector in this world, I believe that it can be a different. But something I even know about the radios and also TV stations and stuff like that, that's what they show, negative. They don't show positive. They don't show about what the gang members or ex-gang members they want to call, what they're up to, what they're doing now. They're only concentrating on the ones that do negative. We cannot only concentrate most of the time on people that do negative. What is that we're doing good in this world now? Why are people changing? Why is it we took the big step in life just to become responsible and be the person that you really want to be, not wasting your time in jail, not be wasting your time, not just having a family and just be happy in this world? A lot of people don't understand that because they don't search. They don't go what we go through in life. It's a lot of pain that sometimes we go through because the father, the mother not being there, I cannot really blame them, but it's part of it. Living inside cars, just using drugs, going through that kind of stuff, you know, it's hard. It's hard, and that's why we got involved. That's why we choose to work with youth, because we can relate. We can relate with them, and we can help. We believe that we can help them out, and we understand that it's a process, but we got to start now. We got to start now so we can make a difference for our communities. Not tomorrow, not the next day, but if we start now, from this day, like we've been doing it, everything will be all right. And I believe on that, because it's been happening.
Us right here, what we've done, we're all gang specialists, and we all been through college. What we're doing now is we're helping the little homies get back into school. And right now, as we speak, we got one of ours that we just put into college, another one. So we're bringing them. We're not just leaving them down. We see them getting kicked down, we'll put our hand there and pick them up. And not to be that we're higher than them. We're their equals. We're all men. We bleed red, you know. And what we got to do is just help the system, because the system's going to take us if we don't change it. Bottom line, they're going to make money off of us by having our 14. I mean, what is it? It's a felony now to write on a wall. I mean, a youngster on the street ain't going to know that. That's strike one. Two more, he's done. And at 18, they're not taking him off no more.
Thinking That Still I'll Rise, written by 12-year-old Luis Carrillo, April 29th, 1992. You may write me down in history with your bitter, twisted lies. You may walk on me in the very dirt, but still like dust I'll rise. Does my smartiness upset you? Why are you full with gloom? Because I walk like oil wells pumping in my living room. Just like moons and like suns with the sureness of tides. Just like hope springing high, still I'll rise. Do you want to see me broken, bowed head and lowered eyes, shoulders falling down like teardrops, weakened by my soulful cries? You may shoot me with your words, you may cut me with your eyes, you may kill me with your hatefulness, but still, like air, I'll rise. Leaving behind nights of terror and fear, still I'll rise. Into a daybreak that's very clear, still I'll rise. Bringing the gifts that my ancestors gave, I'm the dream and the hope of the new generation. Kill me, hate me, but still I rise. I will.
My name is Luis Rodriguez, and I am a writer, poet, author of 8 books, recently called The Republic of East L.A. Stories. Yeah, my memoir, Always Running, La Vida Loca Gang Days in L.A., is precisely about my own gang experiences 30 years ago. And even since then, I've written in various magazines and books, and I also have this other new book, Hearts and Hands, Creating Community in Violent Times, in which I address the issue of gangs and troubled youth and community. I went back to Los Angeles from Chicago about 2 years ago, but since I've been back here, we've opened up a center, community center, of art and poetry and books and coffee, a cafe and everything,
And a lot of young people are coming through. And plus, I still do talks in schools and juvenile facilities, prisons, wherever I can, just talk to young people. I mean, the basic thing is it's getting to the point where there's no other way to go. Everything else has been taken away. The police department, of course, has played a big hand in keeping gangs at each other's throats. And as you know, the LAPD's reputation for also becoming like a gang themselves plays into it. So I think what happened is a lot of young people, especially those that were kind of like politicized through being in the streets, through their relationships with the cops, through everything, they began the truthing process because they saw it as a futile situation that was just not going anywhere. Nobody was going to benefit, at least not in their community. And just that so many people were dying and not, you know, getting anything out of it. It got more politicized during the LA Rebellion and then got institutionalized in some aspects. But the issue is that a lot of the gang truthing fell apart over the last 10 years or so because there wasn't any economic or social means to keep it going. The people that started up Rebuild LA totally ignored the truthing process. They built the supermarkets. They built more taco stands. They built, you know, more of the things that the kids were saying they didn't need anymore. And they ignored the fact that some of the kids were willing to help rebuild the community. And I think that's a big mistake. But in spite of that, there's been still some flares of truthing still going on, particularly in Watts, particularly in some of the housing projects, that continues. And we help try to revive that every year so that that spirit doesn't get lost. One of the efforts we're doing in Watts is because of more than half of the population in Watts is Mexican or Central American, is to try to also bring truth between the black and brown members of the community. That's a big issue. And so we're going from that end. So it isn't just from the red and the blue. We're also trying to see if we can do a truce between the black and the brown, you know. And it's just important in those communities where the you know, Latinos and African-Americans interact, and yet the tensions are very strong. In Chicago, we did have to separate the work we did with the Puerto Rican and Mexican gang youth from the African-American to consider trucing, even though there was also work we were doing with African-Americans who led a lot of the truce process in Chicago. So yeah, it's a separate process. At the same time, there's intersections, and we try as much as possible to bring them together when we can.
Now, we've spoken with Nani and the folks at Barrios Unidos, uh-huh. as well as with Hector and some of the people working with No Guns LA. Right. To what degree are all of these various groups networked, and what is the success of their cooperation?
Yeah. Well, I think they're kind of like the unsung heroes. They do all this work. They don't get as much knowledge or media attention as they should. I believe they truly save lives, and they've been doing it for a long time. And, of course, they work within the Latino communities, but they also do interact with the African-American communities. And I just find that they're very valuable. But, again, what their efforts sometimes just don't get looked at. And it should, because I think they're saving so many people's lives. And particularly with Barrios Unidos, they're also bringing in the Norteño-Sureño rivalries, which is even more deadlier than the Bloods and Crips. And it's still continuing throughout the state and other parts of the country. But my feeling is that they're making big efforts to pull them together, and very few people have been able to do that. The rise in gangs now, because, you know, they go up and down, but they're rising up again. The gang violence has to do precisely with the economic situation. It's really bad. There is a recession. Whether other people recognize it or not, these communities are feeling it. And because you have a large Mexican or Central American community interacting now with a previously African-American community, the tension is going to be great because they're competing for very few jobs. The tendency is for the industries and the service industries to hire the Mexican or Central American workers at very, very low pay, and the more African-Americans are unemployed as a result. But the fact of the matter is that even with the pay, the Mexican and Central American communities are just as poor as the African-American communities, you know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. So they don't really, neither one of them are getting up. They're just fighting over the few crumbs that they have. So, in fact, these communities, I think, have to be kind of educated, and some of them are. There's a lot of process to educate them towards their common interests, towards some common strategies, to see how, in effect, working together, they can get more than if they went after each other. The influx of drugs, you know, they were there 30 years ago, and I saw it personally when drugs really wasn't a big deal with the gangs, but particularly with the Vietnam War. People were coming back from the war addicted, jobless, having learned to kill, and all of a sudden it heightened the situation in the streets, along with the fact that the government was cutting back on programming, cutting back on projects for the community,
and there was the Nixon cuts, there was Proposition 13 in the state of California. Coupled with all that and the destruction of Black Panthers and Brown Berets and other political expressions, you could see the beginnings of the volatile situation that 30 years later we see today. I saw it kind of born during that period. And then in 1980, when President Reagan declared the war on drugs, it actually escalated. One fact is that the war on drugs not only has produced more drugs in the communities, but actually created new drugs that didn't exist before. Like crack did not exist before the war on drugs. Neither did crank and a lot of the other drugs that we're seeing today. So I find that whether it was anybody's intention, the result of the war on drugs has created a more worse drug-dependent communities, which wasn't the case before. Drugs was always there. Since after World War II in particular, there was always heroin. In the barrio, there was always people that you can, heroin addicts. But by the 1980s, you have found drug-dependent communities, and that to me is a result of government not paying attention to the situation or actually instituting issues or so-called problem-solving that in fact created worse problems. I think I get the sense that most people are very much aware of what's happening, much more than people think. I don't understand where they get the polls that give Bush all these great ratings, because I think most people are willing to challenge what the government's doing. So I think there is a growing movement for peace in this country, and you're going to see it more and more. And it's not just the demonstrations, which will be more, but also people speaking out. I think a lot more writers are taking opportunities to speak out. But I think it was an effort. It was infiltration by the government and the various groups, pitting one group against another. People were found dead who nobody could figure out who killed them. You know, there was just so much stuff going on. And it happened in the Black community, it happened in Native American communities, it happened in the Puerto Rican communities, it happened in the poor white communities, it happened in the communities of the white middle-class kids who were fighting back, you know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. And I think what insidious thinking is this? Because what they created, unfortunately, was the basis for the gang warfare that we're seeing today that now has completely, well, I don't want to say completely, but almost gone out of hand. And it was partly that effort to destroy those movements that opened up the ground for these gang, the kind of violence we're seeing within the communities and in the gangs, we would not have seen if we had allowed those movements to continue where they were going. But I think it was an effort. It was infiltration by the government and the various groups, pitting one group against another. People were found dead who nobody could figure out who killed them. You know, there was just so much stuff going on. And it happened in the Black community, it happened in Native American communities, it happened in the Puerto Rican communities, it happened in the poor white communities, it happened in the communities of the white middle-class kids who were fighting back, you know what I'm saying? And I think what insidious thinking is this? Because what they created, unfortunately, was the basis for the gang warfare that we're seeing today that now has completely, well, I don't want to say completely, but almost gone out of hand. And it was partly that effort to destroy those movements that opened up the ground for these gang, the kind of violence we're seeing within the communities and in the gangs, we would not have seen if we had allowed those movements to continue where they were going.
My name is Daniel Nani Alejandres. I'm the executive director of Santa Cruz Barrios Unidos in Santa Cruz, California. Barrios Unidos is an affiliate of the National Coalition of Barrios Unidos, which I am the chairperson of. Barrios Unidos is on its 25th anniversary this year. We'll be celebrating 25 years of existence in Santa Cruz. Within these 25 years, our main mission has been to try to stop the violence in our communities, along with many other organizations throughout the country. Our method has been using educational, cultural awareness, and economic development. What we have found out that throughout these years that we see this as a spiritual movement, that we need to bring awareness, cultural awareness to our young people. In the last 25 years, we've been to many, many funerals and prisons to visit our young people. We definitely feel that there's a need, a spiritual need, to come into our communities to help us to be able to deal with the madness that's occurring throughout this country. Our young people going to prison and killing themselves in the streets, and also to bring economic development to our communities so that we can employ our young people in order to get them out of those risk factors that exist right now in our communities. Barrios Unidos follows the principles and philosophy of César Chávez, you know, and nonviolence, trying to educate ourselves about, you know, the practice of nonviolence, the practice of community organizing, and the practice of economics in terms of owning different enterprises within our own communities that we can also hire and make of our own. We have a lot of young people in our communities that are willing to work. There's a lot of individuals that are willing to put efforts into our communities. We just need to find that avenue that will lead us to what Cesar was talking about in terms of self-determination of how we take care of our own neighborhoods. Well, I think when you have two organizations that come together to develop a truce or a peace initiative or come together and say, you know, enough is enough with violence in our communities, and to be able to hold that for some time to try to make change is very important to everybody else because it gives hope to people that that people can come together, people can former enemies can come together and work together. I mean, they don't have to be hang out together every day, but that they can come to an understanding that this is not right for our communities, that we need to make change. We need to look at why those situations, what happened that made us, you know, become this way against each other when you got brothers fighting brothers, you know, and you got, you know, whole clans and neighborhoods that have families in both sides against each other. That truce gave many communities hope because if it can be done in there, it can be done in small communities. It doesn't have to be a big truce. It could be a truce between, you know, 5-6 individuals against other 5 individuals. You can state that that is happening already, so that those individuals, they know and they understand that they're not the only ones who are going through this. People have gone through this. But what I believe that needed to happen and needs to happen for truces to continue is that the community itself and the government at say need to step up and be able to provide those individuals that have the courage to step up, to be able to provide them and give them tools so that they can sustain that. Because if you don't have economic gain when a situation like that happens, then it starts to fall apart. You know, what little gains people have done start to fall apart because there's no foundation, there's no continuing resources. So it falls apart. So we need to, the community as a whole needs to come and be able to support those individuals. Then other organizations, other groups that are doing that can point to that. This is what happens when you do give those resources to the right people and to create some change after they have stepped up to say that, knowing that they need change within their own community and within themselves.
Black, Red, Blue, and Brown, 10 Years of the Truce and a Look to the Future was produced for Pacifica Radio and the extended family of independent listener-supported stations like this one, and is a co-production of the Pacifica Archives. If you would like a tape of this program, call the Pacifica Archives at 818-506-1077 or visit our website at www.pacifica.org. Special thanks for assistance with this production go to Fernando Velasquez, Pacifica Station KPFK in Los Angeles, KZSC-FM in Santa Cruz, California, and WCBE-FM in Columbus, Ohio. This production is dedicated to the elders and the young warriors of the Barrios Unidos Warrior Circle, where the hearts and minds of generations are open to the path of peace.